welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney, and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
It's not just a case of letting children write with their left hand if they want to, but it is important that they be shown how to, and that it's beginning to appear in some of the curricula, but not all.
We'll hear how left-handed children can be taught to write well. But first, this week is National Maths Week. To mark that event, I'm delighted to speak to a mathematics educator who has joined with the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment to produce a set of videos to show parents how they can help their child with maths. Valerie O'Dowd is a teacher and a lecturer in mathematics education at the Merino Institute of Education. I met up with Valerie to find out more about the videos that are available to parents on the NCCA website. Indeed, Valerie also told me that many teachers have found the videos to be a useful source of ideas as well. When I met up with Val O'Dowd, I asked her first to tell me about the videos she produced with the NCCA.
Well, actually, they're part of a suite of resources that have been developed for the NCCA website. They resulted from parents who were ringing in saying, how can I help my child with maths? Parents are very aware of how they can help their children with reading, but seemingly the NCCA was receiving quite a few queries about how they could help the children with maths. So after a bit of research, it was decided to develop a series of tip sheets and some accompanying videos which would help parents with some ideas for in ways they could work with their children at home.
So how did you go about developing the videos then?
Well, first of all, we worked from the worksheet, from the tip sheets. They were developed with the idea that a parent could perhaps print them off, stick them on a fridge and just have some easy ideas like matching, sorting, setting the table, just normal things that can be done at home. And then we thought that perhaps it might be easier if they could see children doing this. So we approached some parents and asked them if they would be willing to take part. Now, this was unrehearsed, and the activities, they just did the activities with their child in their own home. It was wonderful to see them just behaving naturally with their children. And funnily enough, in the trialing period, this was the one thing that everybody picked up on, was how natural the children were and how much they looked like their own children of the same age.
And presumably the videos are intended for other parents to get ideas for what they can do to help their children.
Yes, that's the whole idea. The videos are very short, 2 to 3 minutes on a specific little topic. And the idea would be that a parent might just look at it and adapt that to use in their own home with their own children.
And what kind of equipment did the parents need in order to help their children learn the maths?
Well, actually, this is the funny thing. The response of all the parents was, you don't need any special equipment. We used simple card games, dice games, using materials from around the house where children were weighing things that were in the cupboard, measuring for a new tablecloth, that kind of activity, using coins from your purse. So these were very, very simple activities. And the feedback we've had in the trialing has been that this was what parents wanted.
And you mentioned there the tip sheets. What exactly is the intention of the tip sheets?
The tip sheets give parents a quick overview of what the child might be learning in that particular class. So far, we've developed them from infants up to second, but already the third, fourth, fifth and sixth ones are being developed, plus a couple of special ones on subtraction and division, which are areas that many parents find quite challenging. So the tip sheets contain an overview of roughly what the child may learn in maths at that class level, for instance, at first class or senior infants. And then some ideas that tie in with that as to how they can help at home in a very simple way. And then there's some ideas on topics such as tens and units or the language of maths, that kind of thing. And they link in directly to the videos. You can read them on screen online where you have a direct link to the videos, or you can print them out, as I said before, and use them at home. It isn't always parents that might be using them. It could well be a favourite auntie or granny who might find these little ideas easy. They really are very simple, ordinary, everyday activities.
Valerie, is there a danger that parents if they're helping their child, that they could confuse the child if they maybe use different language than the teacher would use, or if they do things in a different way than the teacher does it.
There's a difference between helping with homework, and we do address that in one or two of the videos, and actually just doing more general real life maths, letting children see that maths has actually got something to do with what's happening out in the real world. So while a parent might feel nervous about helping with homework, it certainly they can do the general activities. Where homework is concerned, many schools actually send home a sheet giving the language that's being used, or a parent can always just go in and ask the teacher. But I certainly wouldn't be afraid to help your child at home. Even if you're using different language, you can ask the child to tell you, what does the teacher do? Or pretend that you're the pupil and ask the child to teach you. And that way, generally speaking, they'll pretend to be teacher and you'll hear the language that's been used in the classroom.
And I wonder if we took some specific examples, maybe if we take a child maybe in junior or senior infants, what could a parent do to help a child at that age level with maths?
Oh, well, at that level, we're really talking about household activities, matching the socks and gloves, like when you bring down the washing. You can see that in some of the videos. One of the little girls is having great fun matching the socks and saying why she matched particular things together. Talking about it's time to go swimming. Is it late? Is it early? Using the kind of language that the teacher will be using in school, but that you are reinforcing without even realising it. You see children talking about the heaviest item in the cupboard, the lightest item, putting things in order, sorting pencils in their pencil case. All these are really valuable mathematical activities and support totally the work that's going on in school.
And if we move up the school then, say, to first and second class, would there be, I mean, I'm sure you could do some of the same activities. Would there be anything else maybe you could do with that age group?
Yeah, at that stage, children are beginning to think more outside the home, and they're always really, really interested in the biggest, the smallest, the biggest dinosaur, the smallest insect. And particularly at that age, when they're just beginning to do tens and units in first class and second class, using money is fantastic. Just throwing your coins from your purse or your pocket out on the table and asking them to sort them, asking them which ones are worth the most. Can you exchange a 50 cent for other coins? These are activities that are very, very valuable in helping a child to develop tens and units, an understanding of tens and units.
And if we move on then maybe to third, fourth, fifth and sixth, some parents might be finding it more difficult at that stage. But what can parents do with that at those classes?
Oh no, at that stage, you really, the world is your oyster. Money in particular at this stage, for instance, get the children to look at ads in newspapers for food or appliances and get them to find the cheapest washing machine, the most expensive TV. They could look these up on the internet also. One thing that's very useful is to compare mobile phone prices or charges, or work out the cost of a takeaway treat for the family and find out how much it would cost. Working out what time to go to the cinema, how much that will cost. At the moment, petrol prices would be very topical. I know, looking at the signs and seeing where we can get the cheapest petrol, how much it is per litre, how much it would cost to buy so many litres. In the supermarket, looking at 3 for 2 offers. Are they really offers? Looking for bargains, cooking, weighing ingredients. Oh, look, the world is your oyster there with the senior classes. And they really like these activities because it makes them feel so grown up.
And I suppose the other side of it, Val, is that maybe some parents might have had a bad experience of learning maths themselves in school. If a parent did have a bad experience learning their maths, or if they think they're just not great at maths themselves, would they be better off not helping their children at all?
Oh no, I worked with a group of parents at one stage who all described themselves as being very, very bad at maths. However, when I asked them, well, do you go shopping? Do you get your children up in the morning? Do you have a budget for the week for your food? They all said yes. In fact, one of the women was an Avon lady, and yet she hadn't made the connection with the amount of maths that she'd be doing for that. When we spoke later, they realised that actually they were using maths in their daily lives. So saying I'm no good at maths actually can have a very detrimental effect on children. Positive attitudes are terribly important. And if you're saying to your child, oh, I hate maths, maths is only for the geniuses, etc., your child can pick up on this and, you know, feel that they can't be good at maths. Whereas everything we do every day involves maths.
Is there anything in particular that a parent can do if their child is maybe finding maths hard in school?
Yeah, if children are struggling, it's very, very important that both parent and child don't build up a sense of being anxious about it. Then children can see extra help from parents at home as being almost a punishment. It's like, I get extra work just because I can't do it. So it's terribly important that the work you do with the child is fun, such as playing games like snakes and ladders, matching games with cards. You can make little Skittles games from old plastic drink bottles and just put numbers on them and knock them down using a tennis ball. But most important, any work you do with your child, any sitting and listening to what they're saying, telling you how they're doing their sums in work, will give you information, and then you can go in and talk to the teacher about your concerns.
And I suppose the other extreme then is where a child loves maths and just can't get enough of it. What can parents do to help such a child who just kind of has a great appetite for maths?
What a lucky parent. There's no use just moving on to the next textbook. It's often the sort of thing that people think, oh, well, he's well able for that, or she's finished that book. But really what children need is exciting and interesting problems that will really stimulate them. So get them to plan a journey, work out the times and costs of things, work out average scores. And there's a very good website called Enrich, letter N-R-I-C-H, and it's a really good one for stimulating children who are more able and who need more challenging problems. This will certainly keep them busy.
In some homes, Val, both parents might be working and they mightn't have the time to work with their child. Is there anything that they can do to help their children?
Oh yes, I think actually that's probably the case for most people these days. And the main response when we piloted the videos was the fact that none of the activities take an awful lot of time or special equipment. The clips themselves are only 2 to 3 minutes max, and they show you how the emphasis is actually on the informal maths rather than the formal maths. So I think really that's what you're talking about, like simple things like you're looking at the paper to see what time the match starts at. Ask your child to do that and ask them, what time does it finish? And there's one video clip of a little girl, and she's very well able to work out that the match takes 3.5 hours from start to finish, to try and persuade her father to let her stay up to watch it.
Is there anything the schools in particular can do to encourage parents to help their child with maths?
Oh, I think schools mostly are actually making quite an effort. They often send notes home on a particular topic that's being done. I've seen lovely websites where they might say second class are doing a little project on maths today or something like that. Some schools organise a maths fun day, perhaps during maths week. I've seen some very interesting ones of those, or are engaged in competitions with other schools. In GESH schools, there are very often shared maths programmes going, where the school provides games with mathematical content in them, and the parents can borrow them and respond back as to how they got on playing with them at home. Maths for Fun is another project that's used in some schools, where parents come into the school, receive some training from other parents and the homeschool community liaison person, and they actually work for once a week for 4 to 6 weeks, playing games in the classroom. And I've been very lucky to see this in action, and it is a most effective way of the children love seeing their parents there. They love seeing other parents helping them, and it's most effective in giving the children a more one-to-one attention and listening to them as they play their games.
And what's that scheme called again, Val?
That's Maths for Fun, and it's available in a lot of GESH schools only.
Okay, and the videos that you produced with the NCCA, if anyone listening wants to access them, how do they go about finding them?
Oh, they go to the NCCA website, or just type in NCCA/primary parents, and they will come to a menu there where they can pick junior, senior, infants, first and second, and as I say, in online at the moment, getting ready to have third and fourth and fifth and sixth over the next year.
And that was Valerie O'Dowd from the Merino Institute of Education. And I'll put a link to the videos on the programme's website, insideed.com. You are indeed listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from the website, insideed.com. We now move on to the topic of left-handedness. Professor Margaret Clark was in Ireland recently at the annual conference of the Reading Association of Ireland. Her research interests today are in literacy and early years education. She is also an Emeritus Professor of Education at the University of Birmingham and has been awarded an OBE for her services to early years education. 53 years ago, in 1959, she wrote a book called Teaching Left-Handed Children. It was based on her doctoral research. When she visited Ireland, I spoke to her about many things, and I'll bring some of those to you in future programmes. But this week, I'm bringing you some insights from her research into left-handedness. I began by asking Margaret Clark why some people write with their left hand and others write with their right hand.
Can I say, first of all, that I started to do the work on left-handedness because I am left-handed, and at the time I was learning to write, it was very unusual to be allowed to write with your left hand. And I started by observing the classes that I taught, and I realised that there's a wide range of dominance of left or right hand. Of course, as is obvious, the majority of people in most countries, or in all countries we know of, are right-handed. This is the dominant side with many people. But there are gradations of handedness. And in some countries, children are still not allowed to write with their left hand. But I'm sure, I haven't seen any recent statistics, but there are far more children, far more adults now writing with their left hand, and competently with their left hand. I don't think it is linked in some ways with brain development, but I don't think a great deal is known about the reasons for why the majority are right-handed and the minority are left. But some of those who are left-handed are very, very dominant on that side, and the side of their brain that's dominant is the right hand. But others may write with their left hand, but do other things with their right. But there is an encouragement now. It's not just a case of letting children write with their left hand if they want to, but it is important that they be shown how to, and that it's beginning to appear in some of the curricula, but not all. And therefore, if they're not shown how to write correctly, they may develop very awkward positionings for their hand when they're writing, whereas they don't need to. And there's no evidence that they are, if in fact properly taught, poorer writers. People believe that when they see it because they think it looks awkward. But when we've done studies where the person couldn't see who wrote, there is no evidence of a difference.
Now, I know this is radio and it's probably a difficult thing to ask you this, but what can a right-handed teacher or parent, indeed, do to help a left-handed child write well?
Well, first of all, it's difficult to demonstrate it on the radio, but the child should be allowed to slant the paper, move the paper towards the right-hand side, not straight on, and at an angle with... it's so difficult not to reach out and put a piece of paper in the correct place, but so angled in such a way that they don't produce a hook position when they're writing, which then... What they were doing in the past to do that was to avoid smudging the paper when they were writing from left to right with a left hand. But I still see many adults who adopt a very awkward position if they're writing with their left hand, which is an unnecessary thing. One in question is Prince William. Every time they show him signing in at Eton, it makes me want to scream because he's adopting a hook position as he's signing in the register. And that's an example of what needn't have happened.
So a hook position then is not a good thing when you're writing?
Well, it's a very uncomfortable position, actually, to adopt. It's a strain which needn't have happened if the paper had been towards the right and at an angle, just as somebody writing with their right hand would find it easier to write with the paper slightly to the left and, again, angled slightly in the opposite direction.
I spoke to a mother recently who had a 5-year-old daughter who recently started primary school, and sometimes she writes with her left hand and sometimes with her right hand. Should she have established a preference at this stage? She's 5 years of age.
Most children probably have established a preference by then. There was an attempt in the past to sort of force the children to adopt one or other. But I would imagine in most cases it will come and come fairly soon. There are a few adults and children who are virtually ambidextrous. In other words, they're good with both hands. But there are others who seem not to have much dominance. And there's been a lot of controversy as to whether that is linked with reading difficulties. I don't think it's been well enough substantiated, and it certainly hasn't been substantiated that there's a link between left-handedness and reading difficulties.
Margaret, you've a long and distinguished career in research to date. Can you say, how do you go about doing your research?
I've always started from something which has troubled me, if you like, something which has either because of some government decision, which I have been unhappy about, or something I've witnessed. For example, the left-handedness started because I was teaching. I had to do a dissertation, and to be honest, it was my lecturer who suggested that there wasn't much work on left-handedness and that I should do it. Some of the other researches, the reading one looking at the community, was because there were so many claims that about an association between dyslexia and various aspects of handedness, things like that. And I decided that it was important to get a community study where you looked at every child and you didn't just have clinic cases. So that in each of the research, because I've done researches in very many areas, there's been something, if you like, there's been a trigger. And to be honest, the start of my work in preschool was at the invitation of the local authority in which I had done the previous work on literacy. And they had just opened their first nursery school, and they invited me to go in and work in that nursery school. I later did further work in nursery schools, and that was looking at children with disabilities who were placed in ordinary nursery schools to look and see what kind of treatment they were getting and whether it was in any way beneficial to them. And that was linked with a government inquiry. So some of them have been linked with some inquiry that's been taking place, and others have been something which has hit the headlines and I've thought, I'm not happy about that. I wonder if that's true or if an empirical study could throw light on that. For example, we did a lot of recordings with radio microphones of young children in different settings, and we saw how variable their quality and the quantity of their language was depending on who they were in dialogue with and whether they felt comfortable and whether it was something that interested them. And we got a lot of rich information from that.
Finally, Margaret, you're here to speak at the Reading Association of Ireland annual conference. If there was one thing that you wanted teachers to remember from your visit to Ireland about teaching reading, what would it be?
That there is certainly no one right method of teaching reading. There is no evidence of that. That it's important that the quality of the written material that children first encounter in school is high, so that they are stimulated to think that it's worthwhile reading. if they don't have that, then it's very difficult to see why they should be motivated to think it's anything other than a chore that they engage in school. And this is particularly important because there's growing evidence of a drop in the amount of reading done by boys and girls now. And every study over the last 10 years has shown that that boys and girls, as they grow older, are reading less and less. So the quality of what they're offered in the school is vitally important.
And that was Professor Margaret Clark, who is Emeritus Professor at the University of Birmingham, speaking to me at the annual conference of the Reading Association of Ireland. And I'll bring you more from my interview with Professor Margaret Clark in future Inside Education programmes. Well, that's just about it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us with comments or suggestions at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guests on the programme this week, Valerie O'Dowd from the Marino Institute of Education and Professor Margaret Clark from the University of Birmingham. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.